Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's the incredible shrinking city.
There is no need for five different elementary schools within a 1 mile radius of my home when half of the homes on my block are boarded up because people have moved out.
That's Jamaica Kendricks of Kansas City, which last week shuttered dozens of schools, in part because of population loss. And it isn't only Kansas City. Since 1950, 8 of the 10 largest cities in the United States have lost population. How do you keep the big American dream alive in a smaller American city? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 15th. I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste Headlee. Morning, John.
It's a big story, the incredible shrinking American cities. The census will be measuring it all.
And it may not all be bad. That's what's so cool.
Interesting. Let's get a check of the morning's top stories. And the big story this morning, two U.S. embassy workers in Mexico are dead in what's believed to be the first attack on American officials and their families by the country's powerful drug cartels. Suspected drug gang hitmen separately ambushed two cars within minutes of each other in the border town of Juarez, killing a consulate worker, her husband, and the husband of another embassy employee. State Department spokesman Fred Lash says the gunmen attacked even though there were children present.
In one of the cars were two children, and they were injured. And in another car with the people that were killed was an infant, and the infant was not harmed.
In a statement over the weekend, President Obama expressed outrage at what he called the brutal murders.
Here at home, more than 120 million census forms begin arriving in mailboxes across the country today. Earlier, we spoke to Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
The census is used to dole out about $400 or $500 billion in federal assistance.
It is also used to divvy up congressional districts. For more, we're joined by Ed Glazer, an urban economist at Harvard University. Morning, Ed.
Good morning.
We are talking all morning about the U.S. Census and changing populations, and it turns out our shrinking cities may not be just bad news, right?
That's right. There's nothing inherently wrong or bad about people moving from places that are less productive to places that are more productive or pleasant. And an added benefit of this mobility is that it forces cities and towns to focus on providing better and less expensive public services.
Fascinating. Ed Glazer, stay with us. We're going to be right back with you in just a few moments. John?
The White House wants a health care bill passed before President Obama heads to Asia this week, but Congressman James Clyburn, the Democrats' top vote counter in the House, when he was asked by NBC News yesterday if the votes are there, said it's going to be a nail-biter.
No, we don't have them as of this morning, but we've been working this thing all weekend. We'll be working it going into the week. I'm also very confident that we'll get this done.
The president heads to Ohio today with another sales pitch for the health care reform bill. March Madness is upon us all. The country's biggest office pool kicks off this week when the NCAA basketball tournament gets underway. Top seeds are Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, and Syracuse. Asian and European markets are down. Futures on Wall Street are down, worrying about the Chinese and American currency sniping. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P opens at 1,149 and the NASDAQ at 2,367. After last month's earthquake, the city of Concepcion, Chile actually moved 10 feet. That's the kind of tantalizing detail that John McPhee, New Yorker writer, loves. He's going to talk about that later this hour. An interview with I consider him a national treasure.
He's spectacular, yeah. But I love that little fact. That's fabulous.
Coming up this morning, we spend time talking about the census. We'll learn later about which communities are actually shrinking. And as Lynn said, it's not all bad news, but we're looking to you for why in your own community. Are you seeing people leave town, people voting with their feet? Is the population shifting? Why are your neighbors leaving? Tell us signs of population shrinkage or growth in your community. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. We'll talk more about downsizing urban areas in just a few moments.
I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste here with John. And As we've been telling you all morning, the census starts today. Da-dum-da-dum. You are being asked a series of questions about your household and yourself. And one of the goals is to identify demographic changes that require long-term government planning, in particular, population growth.
Or as the case may be, non-growth.
Not growth. There you go. Because, as my pal John points out, across America, dozens of towns have seen their population shrink in the past years. For cities like Detroit and Cleveland, the demographic decline started well before the economic downturn. And for others, like Las Vegas, it's all brand new. Last week, Kansas City's Board of Education voted to shut down nearly half its schools in the main school district. And also last week, the mayor of Detroit announced that the city will demolish thousands of its vacant homes for good.
You know, Lynn, some friends of ours from Kansas City actually visited this weekend. They were saying that while the schools are shutting down in the main school district, just across the border in some of the suburbs of Kansas City, they're actually growing and adding schools.
Well, because it's the urban areas that are the ones that are shrinking. So the idea we're going to discuss now, make that shrinking city not only survive, but thrive. And here to talk to us about this, Hunter Morrison, an urban planner in Youngstown, Ohio. He was one of the leading architects of Youngstown 2010, a comprehensive planning effort to make the city smaller, greener, and cleaner. Ed Glazer is a professor of economics at Harvard and director of the Taubman Center for State and Local Government. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So let me start with you, Hunter. This whole concept of downsizing just feels drastic. We've been taught for years, big is good, growth is wonderful. And your city, Youngstown, lost, 5.4% of its population between 2000 and 2007. So it's, and you were, but forgive me, I have to say you were first in a survey of America's downsized city conducted by Forbes last year. Heck of a distinction. So let's talk about this. How bad is it really?
Well, the Youngstown story is really the story of many of this Great Lakes cities. It's lost about half its population since its peak. It's comparable to Detroit and Cleveland. The real distinguishing difference is it's acknowledged that fact and accepted that it is smaller than it was, and it's going to be better as a smaller city as opposed to trying to simply go back to size. That then occasions up a whole set of initiatives in terms of what do you keep, what do you demolish, how can you concentrate on the areas that have opportunity, how can you get more focus in your work in the neighborhoods and in the downtown. How can you leverage your assets like your universities and your hospitals and your government centers?
So this is taking something that feels like it's a bad thing but might be a good thing. Ed Glazer, let me ask you, how many American cities have gone through this kind of major loss of population in the past few years?
Well, it's a half-century phenomenon. 8 of the 10 largest American cities in 1950 have at least 20% less population today than they did then. And Detroit has been losing population decade after decade since the immediate post-war period. Urban decline is in some sense almost the norm in the Midwest and the Northeast.
Hunter Morrison, let's talk about Youngstown specifically. Tell us about Youngstown 2010. How has Youngstown changed as a result of this plan?
Well, the fundamental change has been in the attitude. About 7 years ago, we first announced the Youngstown 2010 vision, which included accepting the fact that we're a smaller city and reframing the goal to be a sustainable mid-sized city, adjusting ourselves to the new regional and global economy, addressing quality of life, quality of place, and taking action. And those have been the four pillars of the effort. Those have really sustained a series of initiatives on the part of the city, the county, the state delegations at the state and congressional level, and also our university.
Was it traumatic? So, was it a traumatic thing to do that?
Actually, 1,500 people came out to Stambaugh Auditorium when we first announced this approach, which really bubbled up from a whole series of focus groups and group meetings. And 3 years later, 1,300 people showed up. This is actually an initiative that is popular and generated from people's broad understanding that going back to being a steel capital wasn't the way to go forward, and a new way had to be found.
It almost sounds as if you're re-embracing a small-town America ideal.
Well, that's a very good way to look at it. The value of a place like Youngstown is it is a small town, and it has a real intimacy, and it has neighborhoods which have real quality and parks that are quite beautiful. How do we focus as a community on what we do well, what we value as a people and as a place, and how we project an image forward to ourselves and to the world that is, in fact, an attractive image as opposed to a sad sack image.
Ed Glaser at Harvard, how much does it cost when a city wants to downsize?
Well, we need to separate out what downsizing means, because there really are different types of downsizing. One type of downsizing is the type that you discussed in Kansas City, which is just shuttering urban facilities. That's, you know, entirely seen as being a cost-saving measure, right? You're not keeping open as many schools as you once did. Kansas City is actually a little bit odd, because Kansas City actually has gained population since 1990, at least according to the census. So Kansas City is a little bit strange that Kansas City is finding itself in the forefront of the downsizing movement. The second thing is what Mayor Bing has discussed, which is actually not providing city services in some parts of the city. Again, that feels very radical, although if you look across America...
That means what? That means bus lines and stuff like that?
You know, he hasn't been precise. I don't know if that means bus lines. I don't know if that means garbage removal. But there are large swaths of America where you're responsible for having your own garbage picked up, and you're responsible for your own water provision. So it may be less radical than it seems. And again, it's seen as a cost-saving measure. The real money involved comes when you're actually going to start tearing down buildings. And again, there's a continuum here of, you know, there's very little sort of public controversy over tearing down those buildings that are empty, dilapidated, and obvious health risk there. It's just an issue of spending the thousands of dollars that are needed to tear them down versus the larger ambition, which is, look, you're going to tear down an entire neighborhood and a neighborhood that still has people living in it. And that's where this thing really has bite and becomes, more challenging, more politically challenging, and much more expensive.
And clearly this is an issue we will be revisiting. Ed Glaser, professor of economics at Harvard, Hunter Morrison, urban planner in Youngstown, Ohio. We're going out on Youngstown. Let's check in on stories we're following now at 15 minutes after the hour.
President Obama is in Ohio trying to secure enough votes to pass his health care reform plans before he heads to Asia on Sunday. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told Fox News Sunday that passage of the health bill is just a matter of days away.
We'll have the votes when the House votes, I think within the next week.
Meanwhile, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Christopher Dodd, is expected to unveil a revised financial overhaul bill today. That bill would create a consumer protection agency. It would expand the regulatory powers of the Federal Reserve as well. Overseas, a suicide bomber has struck in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, killing at least 7 people and wounding more than 13. And in Thailand, the prime minister has rejected an ultimatum from anti-government protesters to call for a snap election. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have been on the streets of the capital, Bangkok, this morning, and they say the government is illegitimate.
The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says reconstruction in Haiti is moving quickly. The UN chief is in Haiti on his second visit since January's earthquake. Secretary Ban says the UN is beginning the transition from emergency relief to reconstruction.
But the situation remains extremely difficult.
Finally, and listen to this, one of the most familiar symbols of the Internet age, the domain name .com, is, ready for this, 25 years old
That's
today.
That's totally awesome.
Who knew?
Whoa.
I'm a .com, by the way. Nearly 86 million active Internet sites now use the name, and 100,000 new .com sites are registered every single day.
You don't look a day over 20. I'm telling you. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, as we heard, the White House says it expects health care reform will pass soon. When? Todd Zwillick will be with us in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Voices of our listeners coming up in just a moment, but our first takeout is with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who wants to talk tactics. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, John.
So, Robert Gibbs was on Fox News Sunday yesterday. It was all about health care reform. Listen to this and tell me if you think the administration hasn't set itself up to fail one more time here.
We'll have the votes when the House votes, I think, within the next week. And I think whoever sits here this time next week, you all will be talking about health care reform, not as a presidential proposal, but as something that will soon be the law of the land.
Call me crazy, Todd Zwillick, but has Robert Gibbs sort of led with the positive, maybe? Isn't the lower expectations game the better tactic here?
No, I don't think so. Not going into a bill as big as this, one they've been trying to pass for as long as this, they, you know, instead of saying, well, we might get it done, we'll try to get it done. No. You say, we're going to the floor. This bill's going to pass. That's the game plan. I think you're right, John. Look, there is a risk of saying we're going to get it done and then have it not get done, of course, and it's a big failure. But hey, Robert Gibbs said that. It's his job to take an arrow for the president if this thing goes down. But a statement like that puts pressure on Democrats. The public listens to Robert Gibbs and now expects that bill to pass. So there is going to be unbelievable pressure all around from Nancy Pelosi and the whip team. You heard from James Clyburn, the Democratic whip,
right,
a couple minutes ago in the headlines.
Who
from
said
the White
maybe
House
there
the
wasn't the votes. I mean, he was a little more negative.
Not yet, but that's the whip's job, to round up those votes. And they're doing all kinds of stuff this week to get those votes. Memos started coming out before the weekend and over the weekend, reminding members of all the positives in this bill. Medicare donut hole, that big gap in grandma's drug coverage, closed. More money for lower income and middle income people to afford insurance. And by the way, there was a flurry of activity at about 11:30 last night. A bill came out. It's inconsequential. It's sort of a shell bill to get this process moving today. But the one important thing is that we know from this this bill that came out last night that about $70 billion in education money for these Pell Grants, loan assistance, tuition assistance, is going to be in this bill, in the reconciliation package. And a lot of Democrats really like that. They've wanted this education money a long time.
And as you said last week, that's really aimed at pulling the progressives along so that nobody sort of backs away, even though there's no public option in the health care reform part of this. All right, what about the tactics? As we get down to the wire, there's more tactical games that can be played, and it seemed like Virginia Republican Congressman Eric Cantor was talking about that on Fox News Sunday when he got on the air right after Robert Gibbs.
And the alarming thing that I'm hearing now is that Speaker Pelosi is thinking about bending the rules and, frankly, making it so there's not a direct vote on the Senate health care bill.
What is he talking about there, Todd Zwillick?
It's infuriating to Republicans. You have the Senate bill, which has to pass the House. We've said that. And we've said that Democrats in the House hate the Senate bill. So they're going to have this package of fixes in the reconciliation package. What Cantor is talking about is a notion, and we're going to find out by midweek if this is what they're actually going to do. Take the reconciliation package, which is very popular, easy to pass. All that nice stuff that I talked about a minute ago is in there. Very easy to pass.
Right.
You put that on the floor and you have a vote on that. And the rule that encapsulates this whole thing just says if you pass that nice reconciliation package, the Senate bill, which you all hate, is deemed passed automatically. The beauty of that, you never have to cast the vote that you really don't like. We'll just wink and nod and say it's passed if you pass this other thing that you like.
So procedurally, it just glues the two bills right together. They pass in one fell swoop, and then it's all about the president's signature. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Lynn?
Our next takeout comes from you, our listeners. I hope you remembered to spring your clock ahead yesterday. We gained an hour of daylight, but nearly all of us also lost an hour of sleep.
Yeah.
Some lucky people in Hawaii and Arizona got to sleep in. Yeah, it's tough for this program. But we spent last week having a little fun with the change. We asked, since we're losing time, what do you wish you had more time to do?
This is Nancy from Farmington Hills, Michigan. And if I had an extra hour as a working mom, I would use that hour to do something that I want to do, not for my family, whether that's work out or do a hobby.
Hey, I'm Thomas Freeman. I'm driving to Hilton Head right now, and if I had an extra hour every day, I'd sell it.
So, John, how much would you pay for that hour?
Thomas Freeman's hour? I don't know. 50 cents, 60 cents. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway, and you can share your take there like Patricia did. She says, I'm a geek, so I would use the extra hour to do more research. We actually heard from a lot of writers who said they would stop procrastinating if they had an extra hour. Brian, the pragmatist, says he'd do laundry. Although, Brian, if you only have an hour, that's just one dry cycle. I don't know.
And if you go over to our site, thetakeaway.org, Evelyn says, I'd spend the hour with a therapist trying to figure out why I fret so much about not having time to get things.
That'll work.
And Jenny in Miami writes, sleep, she writes. I once read about a scientist who seated himself for several months in a room with no natural light and no clocks. Colleagues monitored his movements and discovered that before too long, he had settled into a 25-hour daily cycle. So, she says, maybe the reason humans are tired and cranky all the time is because we're forever trying to cram 25 hours of life into a 24-hour day.
Interesting. I love that. I would use my extra hour for sleep, by the way, Jenny. I'm with you. That's interesting. If you want to read about that story, there's a link to that article and all on thetakeaway.org. And speaking of getting an extra hour, folks.
Good morning, Baltimore.
Good morning, Baltimore. Little clip from Hairspray there. Our friends in Baltimore get an extra hour of The Takeaway starting today. We start on WEAA an hour earlier at 6 a.m. Eastern. Good morning, folks. We've got more stuff for you to weigh in on. We're talking the census. We just learned about which communities are shrinking in the United States. We're looking for you to tell us why the population may be shrinking in your community or growing, if that's the case. Tell us the signs of population shifts in your neighborhood at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And you can post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And we have a contest on the takeaway.org. It's a six-word slogan on the news, like the State of the Union. Remember you did that?
I hope we still can.
On second thought, maybe we can't.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
This guy lies through his teeth.
Quit fighting and get the job done.
All those would make great T-shirts. Weigh in at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, brutal reminders of the violent drug wars south of our border, slaying of a pregnant American consulate worker, her husband, and another man over the weekend in Mexico. The latest on the situation in Ciudad Juarez in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Big week for health care reform. The White House wants to see a vote on that bill before the president leaves for Asia on Sunday. House Democrats say the votes maybe aren't quite there yet. President Obama heads to Ohio today with another sales pitch for the health care reform bill. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the president will touch on some familiar themes.
Going through why reform is important, going through what it will do the minute he signs the legislation for on behalf of millions of Americans, discussing what happens again if we decide now is not the time.
Health care apparently not the only overhaul on the president's mind today. He also plans to outline his proposals to rewrite the No Child Left Behind law. There will be less emphasis on standardized testing and a renewed focus on getting kids ready for life after high school. More on this in just a few minutes.
A Defense Department official is under investigation for hiring private contractors to gather intelligence on suspected insurgents in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our partner, The New York Times, reports the contractor sent the intelligence to military units who used it for airstrikes. It is against U.S. policy to use contractors as spies. More than 100 million census forms begin hitting mailboxes today. The once-a-decade population count is used to decide congressional districts and more than $400 billion in federal aid. And actor Peter Graves has passed away. His most memorable role was in the 1960s TV series, Mission Impossible. But he's also remembered as the pilot in Airplane. Here he is in a scene with Leslie Nielsen.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me I'm a doctor.
No, I mean, I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
No. I mean, we can't land for another 2 hours.
Peter Graves, a great sense of humor about himself, died of apparent natural causes at his home in Los Angeles. He was 83 years old. Let's check the markets now. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P opens at 1,149. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,367. And those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning. John?
Now you can hear it in the background there. More tragic news comes from the drug war-torn border between the U.S. and Mexico. Three people with ties to the American consulate were shot and two killed in two shootings this weekend in Ciudad Juarez. One of the slain was an American consulate employee gunned down in her car, along with her husband near a bridge to El Paso, Texas. Their one-year-old daughter was unhurt in the back seat. The shootings appeared to be the first deadly attacks on American officials and their families by these drug organizations. What it means for the ramping up of violence or the Mexican government's ability to contain the violence is still unclear. But for the latest, we're joined now by Joan Grillo, Mexico City correspondent for Time magazine. Joan, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey, how you doing?
So this is a brutal escalation, it seems, at the very least. But give us a sense of how violent Ciudad Juarez is, even if we weren't talking about this story this morning.
Well, Ciudad Juarez has been an extremely murderous and violent city the last 2 years. By many counts, is in fact the most murderous city in the world. You know, that means the homicide rate in Ciudad Juárez, it's about 160 for every 100,000 residents, could well be the highest on the entire planet. That's worse than Baghdad, worse than Mogadishu, or worse than some violent American cities like New Orleans.
So does the murders over the weekend that that I spoke about a moment ago, do they appear to be targeted? Does there appear to be a message for U.S. State Department employees? And the State Department has already issued a warning saying move family members out of the area for the next 30 days.
Well, it's still unclear exactly why these people were targeted. But there are indications that it was, a very organized hit. There was two different attacks on these officials which happened at the same time. Now, both had left an event of consular officials inside Ciudad Juárez. So it seems that the attackers knew they were associated with the U.S. consulate, timed both attacks at the same time. Now, some Mexican officials are already saying they believe the people behind this attack are connected to the Juarez drug cartel. So we've already got indications that it is drug-related, connected to this organized crime group, and deliberately targeting the American officials. What we don't know is why they would get these people. Is it a message to the American State Department? Is it a message to the American DEA or other groups for attacking drug cartels? Or is it some other personal reason connected to these individuals?
Now, you're in Mexico City, and I'm wondering how difficult this story is to follow, because each of these border cities has its own particular battleground, its own particular set of tactics, and it represents its own set of challenges for reporters.
That's correct. I mean, you know, I've been actually based in Mexico since 2001 following this story, and you do see that, you know, it seems to be different conflicts in different regions. You have Ciudad Juárez, you have Tijuana, you have Reynosa, Michoacán, Guerrero, and each time you have different local organized crime groups, different situations. We try and get a sense, as well as moving around to all different places to follow this, to get a sense of the bigger picture here. What's really the big picture in Mexico? Why is there so much violence, you know, and why are all these different locations having these different conflicts breaking out?
Well, you know, one of the incidents over the weekend reminded me of the situation in Egypt, where terrorist groups in Egypt, when they really want to sting the government of Hosni Mubarak, go after the tourist industry, and you have a shootout in Acapulco over the weekend, a gang shootout where 9 people were killed, and this we're getting right into the middle of spring break, which is a huge tourist attraction, business opportunity for the Mexican government.
Well, it certainly is, and all these kind of news is very bad for Mexico's tourist industry, which has already suffered over the last couple of years because of drug-related violence as well as swine flu, some other things. Now, it's hard to work out exactly why the attacks are carried out. The violence in Acapulco, you know, would appear that was, you know, to do with between the drug cartels and wasn't a direct attack on the tourist industry. Generally, drug cartels haven't targeted tourists or haven't had the mentality of let's attack tourism to damage the government. But whereas the attack on the U.S. consular officials seems a little bit more ominous, seems like it could be directed towards the U.S. government generally or towards a particular agency of the U.S. government to try to send a message in response, perhaps, to certain attacks on the cartel's interests.
Finally, is it in the interest of these cartels to push some threshold of U.S.-Mexican relations that might motivate the Pentagon to actually send troops across the border or to put covert operations forces inside Mexico and escalate the violence that way?
Well, that's certainly a possibility happening. I mean, you know, the Pentagon has obviously had a lot of concern about this situation. There was one paper put out by the Pentagon at the end of 2008 where they were projecting possibilities, and they were saying, well, Mexico's a real problem here. We've got to look in the next 10, 20 years of the possibility of Mexico really falling apart from this violence. We would have to do something about that. We could not let, for the purpose of homeland security, we could not let Mexico fall apart. So that's a real possibility. I don't think it's really in the cartel's interest for that to happen. I don't think the cartels want to have Pentagon or more U.S. forces against them. I think they probably would like Mexico to send a message to try and stop American officials being around their business, to try and make it more difficult for American officials to operate here against the cartels.
Again, violence and the details are mystifying since the intent is not completely clear. Johan Grillo writes about Mexico for Time magazine and reports for Global Post. He joined us from Mexico City talking about the tragic news over the weekend. Three people with ties to the American consulate shot, two killed in the shootings in Ciudad Juarez. A couple of facts we should remind you of. 2,500 people were killed last year alone in Ciudad Juarez, and at least 11 people were killed besides the ones I just mentioned in Ciudad Juarez over the weekend.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherer in for Celeste Headlee. There may be nothing more important, how our children are educated. Later today, President Obama will send his plan to Congress. It would overhaul the very controversial Bush-era education policy known as No Child Left Behind. That plan was aimed to close the achievement gap between white children and other races, but it came under fire from critics who said it just didn't work.
What this plan recognizes is that while the federal government can play a leading role in encouraging the reforms and high standards we need, the impetus for that change will come from states and from local schools and school districts.
The president talking about his plan. Allison Klein is a congressional reporter with Education Week. She's been following this story. She's here to explain what the new changes are and who they could affect and how they could affect the schools in your neighborhood. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with the very basic. No Child Left Behind, very controversial program. Isn't the first thing the president wants to change that name?
Yes, the president is hoping to give this new version of the law a different name, but we don't know yet exactly what that name will be.
Okay, and then the big change in terms of content, instead of the standardized testing to deal with the discrepancies among the races, he's talking about either students being either college-ready or career-ready from the moment they graduate. What does that really mean?
Well, that would mean basically that states would have to work with their institutions of higher education to set higher standards that are college and career-ready standards. Basically, students in those states would be able to start college without having to take any remedial courses, or they would be ready for a career. And they still would have to take standardized tests to see if they're prepared to meet that goal, but they would sort of be reaching for that higher bar as opposed to where some of the standards are now, which some folks say are too low and don't really prepare students for college.
It sounds as if the onus now then will be on the schools and on the educators.
Certainly, there will be a lot of high expectations for schools and educators to bring students up to these more rigorous standards.
What are teachers saying about it so far?
Well, the two major teachers' unions say they're very disappointed in the blueprint. They say that it places too much responsibility on teachers without giving them enough authority and autonomy.
What do they want? What kind of authority do the teachers want that they're not getting with this new, what we believe is the new program?
Well, they've talked about time for planning and collaboration, and they're worried that teachers will be judged too much on students' test scores.
And not enough on?
Well, they would like to see, I think in their words, kind of a more holistic picture of student achievement.
Right. Rather,
of course, they're still digesting the blueprint, so I think we'll have a better idea of where they see the problems and pitfalls in coming weeks.
Okay. Allison Klein, congressional reporter with Education Week, and this is the bill we will be waiting for. Thanks very much to you. And now to those of you out there, our takeaway question. President Obama making serious new changes to Mr. Bush's education plan, No Child Left Behind. The name will change. What would you name a national education plan to fix our schools? Give us your very creative suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What would you replace No Child Left Behind with?
Good morning, John Huckaberry here with Lynn Scherer. Coming up, we're going to talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author John McPhee about his new book, Silk Parachute. It's a collection of fantastic essays, and he's a great conversation just all by himself. That's
love
in just
John
a few
McPhee.
Minutes. But first, let's check in on stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. The 2010 census officially starts today. More than 120 million households will start to get their census forms in the mail. Government officials are urging cities and states to promote participation. The last time the country was counted, in 2000, about 72% of U.S. households returned their forms. The internet domain name .com celebrates its 25th anniversary today. Nearly 86 million internet sites now use the name, and 100,000 new .com sites are registered every single day. About 113 million others have come and gone over the past quarter of a century.
Overseas, the Vatican has been attempting to distance the Pope from reports in Germany criticizing him for his handling of a sex abuse case 30 years ago. Reports say a priest suspected of sex abuse against children was sent to Munich when the Pope was Archbishop of that city. Joining us now is David Willey, Vatican correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Good morning, David.
Morning.
Why now, and what's critical about these allegations?
Well, the allegations have snowballed during the past week, and the German press has been absolutely full of cases of alleged sexual abuse by priests, to the extent that the Vatican has resorted to a sort of damage control. We've had two statements from the Vatican official spokesman trying to limit the damage and distancing the Vatican from any criticism of the Pope himself for what he might have done or not done when he was Archbishop in Munich 20 years ago. This has not really succeeded very well, because simultaneously there are sexual abuse scandals by clergy in many other countries, notably Ireland, where the 26 archbishops have recently been in Rome to called by the Pope to deal with very grave allegations there. And now I see that the leader of the Catholic Church in Ireland is resisting calls for his resignation. It's really a very, very serious story for the Vatican.
And can it, in fact, damage the Pope?
Yes, I think the damage has been done. I mean, it remains to be seen now how the Vatican is going to play this. But the credibility of the Catholic Church is at stake in many countries.
David Willey, Vatican correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
Wow.
Thanks very much. That's a big story.
And David Willey knows.
Yeah,
sure.
That's a very big story. Finally, actor Charlie Sheen is due to be arraigned today in a Colorado courtroom. He is charged with domestic violence stemming from a Christmas Day dispute with his wife while they were on vacation. Sheen is accused of putting a knife to his wife's throat. He has denied the allegations. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it's one of these facts that just tantalizes the mind, kind of stops you cold. NASA determining on its GPS detectors that the city of Concepcion in Chile, after the 8.8 magnitude earthquake, moved about 10 feet to the west. It's just the kind of fact that would delight New Yorker writer John McPhee, who joins us now to talk about his new collection of personal essays entitled Silk Parachute. But McPhee is also the author of 28 other books, including a number of extraordinary books on what the Earth tells us, its geology, particularly North American geology. John McPhee joins us from his home in Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Do you think you've been able in your retelling of the geological stories in your books to shrink the planet, to allow people to see with a bigger gaze of what's going on, independent of just a fossil here, a crack there, a look in the fossil record in another place?
Well, the fossil record is paleontology, and it's a related but separate topic. The thing that I was most preoccupied with was tectonics, the story of the 20-odd major plates and numerous microplates and how they move around, interact with each other, create mountains, create oceans over time.
And, you know, it's a really interesting contrast. You've written so much about geology. Have you ever experienced an earthquake yourself?
No, to my regret.
And you wish that you could.
Yeah, I mean, a nephew of mine was in California whenever one of those happened in Southern California, and the Whittier Narrows earthquake or something, and he was in a grocery store with the Campbell soup falling off the shelves, and I envied him no end.
And what is it about the motion that you want to feel, which sort of describes the story that you have told again and again in your geology books?
Well, it would just be interesting. I mean, I can imagine it all right, because I've read so much about it, but I just sort of like to feel it. The mobility of the Earth is something a lot of people don't think of until it moves underneath them.
You know, in all of your writing about geology, do you think it's possible to make sense of a 90-second event that unfolds a narrative that's millions and millions of years in the making? Have you become better at understanding an event like an earthquake?
The incremental effect of tectonics and so forth is a fantastically slow, and human life, by comparison, is very fast and short. And so the two don't intersect all that often, but sometimes they do. In 1989 at Loma Prieta, they intersected. And in this year in Concepcion, they intersected, and so forth. And that intersection is extremely dramatic in human terms. And in geological terms, it has something to do with the gradual elevation of the Andes. It's a really strange interface, as it were, but it's there, and it happens when these two hairs cross, when human time and geologic time intersect.
And a tiny event in geologic time becomes a huge, maybe historic event in human time.
Exactly.
This book of essays that you've just come out with is a very personal story of a lot of your choices as a journalist. And I mean, I could bring out a lot of particular stories in here, but the one that the book is named after, Silk Parachute, talks about your mom, who was something of a critic of Alfred Knopf back in your early days.
Well, I was a critic of Alfred Knopf because when I wrote something I was actually a college student, and I sent it to Knopf, and they rejected it. And a professor of mine said, write and ask them for the reader's report. So do you a lot? They might help you. You could find out, you know, things. So I wrote to Alfred Knopf, and he writes back and says, if you had the reader's reports, they might discourage you completely. I still have his letter. But, I mean, I was not a critic of him until that moment.
And you showed that to your mother, and what did she say?
Someone should go in there and knock his block off.
No one ever did.
No, I guess not.
But she would be the first candidate in my book to do that. Is it unusual that you've turned to these personal stories at this stage in your career? And I don't want to prejudge your output.
No, but,
28
you know,
books,
I wonder about that. I think that, you know, as years pass, that there's more touches like that in the work. I mean, this piece is, this book, Silk Parachute, just consists of pieces that I've written recently. But almost each one has some kind of autobiographical component that kind of explains why I'm interested in the overall subject at all.
Well, if you're a fan of John McPhee's work and you read Silk Parachute, you get all sorts of insights into what led this author to go here and write this book or that book. A lot of the favorites are actually in there. New Yorker writer John McPhee, thanks so much for being with us here on The Takeaway. We'll have an extended interview with you on our website, because I want to talk with you more about what it's like behind the scenes at The New Yorker, in maybe even a virtual sense. That's all on our site, thetakeaway.org.
And just for the record, I do not want to be in an earthquake.
Isn't that amazing? He wants to be in an earthquake.
Actually, I have been in an aftershock. Yeah. It's
we both
very
were
scary.
At the Northridge. We covered the Northridge
exactly
for ABC
right.
News. That's right.
Exactly. Well, when you are on our site, you can have your take on the census, because some cities are shrinking. We're looking to you to be our eyes in your town. If you left your city, why'd you go? Maybe you're seeing your neighbors are leaving. Why? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Peg also weighed in with just her own census experience. She writes, every census, our family refuses to answer the race questions. Every time a census taker comes to our home to get us to fill in this stupid question, I argue and refuse. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, the taker fills it in just by looking at me. I think, she writes, income is a much more important question. After all, the smallest minority by income has the greatest amount of wealth. That's Peg on our site. Tell us your own story at thetakeaway.org.
I'd like to meet Warren Buffett, census taker, that's for sure. Before we wrap up this hour, we're looking for your help. Create the new Takeaway T-shirts by sending us your six-word slogan. Here's some. Ask me about my resume. Cross the tracks, not the aisle. Do it at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Sherrin for Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.